Now we've had a hot couple of days in Wisconsin, and on this edition of Food Friday, we're going to get some advice on making cool meals that don't need a whole lot of heat to make. We've got St. Norbert College's executive chef with us for some advice and recipes for beating the heat in our kitchens, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. When the weather is hot, what do you go to make that meal? Salads, sandwiches, out in the grill if you don't heat up inside the house, or is it all takeout, or maybe even going out to a restaurant? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Josh Swanson is executive chef of St. Norbert College. He's got a lot of restaurant experience along the way, too. Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me today. I'm super excited to be here.
Now, before we get to the cooking side of things, I want to look at the demand side. Now, you've cooked for restaurant customers. You've got a whole campus worth of students on your mind. What is it that people seem to want from you when the days are hot and they're looking for a meal?
Well, at the college, a lot more salads. We sell just a ton more salads and then lighter food as well.
Let's talk about salad a little bit, because that's one of those foods that I love when somebody else makes it for me. And when I make it myself, it's really boring. I've talked to so many Food Friday guests. What is your advice for making a salad that's, you know, fun and a little bit different?
What I'd really suggest, actually, is you go buy yourself one of those little blender bottles that people use for protein shakes. And learn the basic ratio of a vinaigrette, you know, 2 parts vinegar, 3 parts oil, whatever you really like. And you can pretty much use any vinegar and any oil and then any flavorings that you'd like. So if you want a garlic for an allium or a chili flake because you like it spicy. But if you make your own homemade vinaigrette, it's super easy to do. And you can really kind of put a riff on things and really impress your guests.
I got to say, that is one of those things, homemade salad dressing, that seems like, oh, that's pretty fancy and too big, you know, too fancy for Rob to make. And then when I've made it from recipes, I'm like, this is really easy.
It's so easy to make and customizable. And then from there, you know, just stop by a farmer's market, buy whatever veggies look good, cut them in the way you like, and toss them with your homemade vinaigrette, and you're done. It's actually really easy.
And it's, you know, Wisconsin, midsummer, it's a good time for produce. What are some of your favorite seasonal types of produce this year to throw in that salad with that homemade dressing?
Well, one of the big unsung heroes of the Wisconsin farmers market is kohlrabi. You can pretty much get it for most of the farmers market season. The bulbs start to get really nice and big as you go later in the year. It's really good for you. It's got a really nice crunch and crispiness to it, but it doesn't have an overbearing flavor, so you can really mix it with anything. You can cook with it if you want, or you can eat it raw. It's just a great versatile vegetable.
We are talking about great things to make when it's really hot outside. It could be salads. It could be a whole lot more. Josh Swanson is with us on Food Friday, executive chef at St. Norbert College. Hoping to hear from you at 800-642-1234. You just got home. It's hot outside. What do you want to make that's not going to heat up the house too much? Share yours or join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Josh, you've shared a couple recipes with us. We have them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, this first one uses a little bit of heat to boil some noodles we've got. And this sounds great to me. A soba noodle salad. I love a cold noodle salad. What goes into this one?
So it's just some soba noodles. You make the GGS dressing, which is going to be garlic, ginger, and scallion. That's those are three of my favorite little buddies in the kitchen. You can pretty much put them with just about anything. They'll make it better. A little sesame oil in there, a little chili flake for fun. I like to use this sauce in combination or as a substitute for soy. It's called Yondu sauce. And that's it's kind of like a vegetarian fish sauce, if you would. It's got a lot of funk and umami. It's part of the process of making miso. It's kind of this liquid that they come up with when they make the miso, and it's just got a lot going on. It's also low in sodium, which is really nice, so I like to use that. But the soba noodles are really fun. They've got a little bit more chew to them. You could use a rice noodle in this too if you wanted to, you know, and stay completely gluten-free. You can buy gluten-free soba noodles. You got to look for them a little bit, but they are available out there. So it's just a nice, fun, light dish. You could really put any vegetable. I think the recipe I gave you, there's some scallions in there and a little bit of Napa cabbage. I love Napa cabbage this time of year because it's nice and fresh and crisp and bright. And again, you don't have to cook it. So you can make that cold salad One of my favorite things to do this time of year is make a cold salad or a cold plate, and then fire that grill up and heat up a piece of salmon or a piece of chicken or whatever your preference is, and top that cold salad with it, and then you get a nice dose of protein as well as that refreshing salad.
Again, that recipe is online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Libby is with us in Eau Claire. Libby, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to share with us, Libby?
Well, one of my favorite things to have when it's hot outside is to make fries out of jicama and kohlrabi and then dip it in like a chili lime dressing. It's so good.
And now when you're talking about those, these are things you can eat raw, the jicama and the kohlrabi. Are you just cutting them into a fry shape? Or are you actually frying them or cooking them in some way?
Just cutting them raw into a fry shape.
Okay, and tell me about, that sounds great, and tell me about your chili lime dip.
So I use a sour cream and mayo base, and then I add lime dressing and chili, and that's about it. It's really good.
Libby, thanks a lot for sharing that. Josh, that basic concept of cold vegetables dipped in a yummy dip, it's hard to go too wrong.
It's really hard to go wrong with that. That sounds excellent. Exciting stuff and good flavors for the weather.
Fantastic. Libby, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Liz joins us now in Elkhorn. Liz, hi.
Yeah, this morning I put my crock pot on and sprayed it down, and I put vegetables in it. I put a small pepper with grits and some pink lentils and some green chilies on top for moisture, a potato, celery, broccoli, a zucchini slice, and squash slice, and just drizzled it off with some oil, and then put on some seasoning and garlic. And then I put paper towels, a cloth, and then a lid, and then let it on slow for like 3 4 hours.
Okay, now
Came
grits.
out really good.
I want to hear about the texture here. You got grits, you got lentils, and you got these veggies in the slow cooker. What, on low for a couple few hours? What kind of texture
So
do we end up
actually,
with?
I stuffed a pepper with that.
Oh, you stuffed the pepper? Oh, that's brilliant. I love it, Liz.
It is with the pink lentils and then the green salsa sauce on top for moisture instead of water. And that's slow cooked and everything else roasted.
You don't have any Polish, do you, Liz? Is this a vegetarian gwumki?
Well, you know what? I'm Ukrainian,
It's
half
close enough.
Ukrainian. So, yeah, this could be like the start of a borscht or something like that. Yes. But you could eat this. I ate it just completely on the plate, had a ready lunch. I disregarded that, threw it on the plate, ate it warm. It wasn't hot anymore. But you could eat it cold, too.
Liz,
So
I
you could
love
just
it.
flip
Thank you so
it and
much
have it in
for.
the fridge.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Liz. So turning to the slow cooker in the summer, right? You're still cooking there, but I do this in the summer a lot because it doesn't put out that much heat, like say the oven or a big couple of pots and pans will, Josh.
Indeed, if you can limit the vessels that you're using, it's always nice to limit the dishes as well.
Do you have, I don't know if you use a slow cooker much yourself, Josh, but if so, do you have favorites for this time of year?
So I do use a slow cooker. It's not really something I go to personally at this time of year, more or less because typically if I'm using a slow cooker, I'm going to do a braise or something like that. I guess there is one recipe I can think of where I'll take pork shank, smoked preferably, and braise them with some gochujang, which is a Korean chili paste, and then just do lettuce wraps. That's one of my family's favorite dishes for me to make this time of year. You get some nice butter lettuce, cut up any vegetables you have laying around, maybe get crazy with it and have some bean sprouts. And then I go out in the garden and I gather some herbs. Right now, I've got some Thai basil and cilantro that are doing really well. So I'd gather some herbs up, make a nak cham dressing for dipping, and you take that nice, really super rich braised meat. You put it in that little wrap of butter lettuce, or you could use perilla if you wanted, and then put whatever veggies you want, and then dip it in the sauce, and you're good to go.
That sounds fantastic. Liz, thanks a lot for that call. Carrie joins us now in Eau Claire. Carrie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hey, I was just thinking that I'm just heading down to our land on the Chippewa, and we use our air fryer a lot down here because it really is so multifaceted that you can cook a lot of things if it's really if it's raining or if it's really hot out and you don't want to grill. So I'm going to try some brats tonight, but I wondered if your guest ever uses his air fryer and what he cooks in it.
Sure. Before I let you go, Carrie, air fried brats. I caved and got into the air fryer thing. I got one of those combo air fryer toaster oven looking deals. Have you done brats in the air fryer before?
No, but I have done a whole steak that was frozen, and it cooked it perfectly in 20 minutes.
Interesting, Carrie. Thanks a lot. Josh, any air fryer thoughts?
Yeah, I worry a little bit about the air fryers just because if they're not cleaned properly, they can be a fire hazard. But I do have one at home, and I do like using it. It's basically a mini convection oven, and that's something a lot of people don't have in their home is a convection oven, or they don't really know how to use it. And it's just a great tool. Professionally, we use the convection oven all the time because it cuts the cooking time in about half. And with the fan running on high, you can really spread the air around. And when you're cooking, it's all about, the level of moisture in your food. Moisture matters, if you would. And, you're able to remove more moisture, which results in more browning, which results in more delicious food and in less time. So that's that steak that she made. That sounds great because you can put it in the air fryer and just go. So, yeah, I'm a proponent for them.
Carrie, I'll hit the road after the show and be by for those brats. We're talking to Josh Swanson, executive chef at St. Norbert College. It's Food Friday. We're talking about hot weather cooking, ways to beat the summer heat with no or minimal heat recipes. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you like to make on a hot day in the summer? What is your go-to, whether it's in the kitchen, on the grill, or takeout? Nothing wrong with that either. Let us know about it. Do you need some advice from our guest? And even if you're not the cook, what kind of foods do you like to eat on a hot day? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation. Get another recipe, by the way, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with St. Norbert College Executive Chef Josh Swanson. We're looking into noodle salads, chilled soups, other cold cooking ideas to beat the summer heat, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you got a hot day like today, you're in charge of cooking. What do you like to make? What do you like to make to avoid turning on the oven or stove, or at least minimizing that indoor heat? What are your favorite things to eat when it's hot? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls. Steven is with us in Beloit. Steven, hi.
Hey, how are we doing today?
Good. What do you got for us?
Well, I've got a fun recipe. It's cubed up watermelon with a little balsamic vinaigrette on it and then goat cheese. Throw a little bit of salt and pepper on top and it's super delicious.
Awesome. Do you have the good watermelon in your area, that good fresh stuff that's going to taste great with those flavors?
Yeah, it's especially if you can find it from a local farmer's market.
That's great. Is this a crowd pleaser, Steve?
Every time I've made it, it's been a fan favorite.
Awesome. Steven, thanks a lot for calling in. Josh, I got to admit, this is something I don't think a lot about, taking a fruit and mixing it with savory ingredients, in this case, watermelon with balsamic and goat cheese. Do you have any go-tos along those lines?
Well, a tomato is technically a fruit, so you probably have mixed a fruit before.
Fair. Very true.
I love the watermelon in a salad. I think it's probably 10 or 15 years ago, watermelon and feta salads were all the rage. But for me, man, he's after my heart with that goat cheese, that fresh Chev. There's a cheesemaker locally that I buy it from, Caprine Supreme, and they make some excellent goat cheese that really goes with that, that sweet watermelon and kind of the creamy, little bit dry goat cheese. One thing that I like to do or I've done in the past, if you have a food saver at home, that little vacuum machine, in the restaurants, we have a, actual vacuum machine. You take a watermelon or a honeydew or a cantaloupe and you put it in a bag with a little bit of lime juice, maybe some tequila, whatever you're feeling at the moment, a little bit of honey, and you compress it. Compressed melon is just amazing, especially watermelon, because it'll actually smush it and take all the air out of it. So you've never had as flavorful of a watermelon as if you've ever had compressed watermelon. It's amazing.
Wow. All right, Steven, great. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Josh, you shared another recipe. I just did a quick check. This is another thing that I call a vegetable. It's botanically a fruit. The cucumber, I got cucumbers doing pretty good in my garden right now. You've got a recipe for sesame cucumbers. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday. Tell us about these sesame cucumbers.
Years ago, my good buddy and chef friend Mike Cheslock showed me this little trick, and it was sesame with cucumber, which you wouldn't think nutty and cucumber exactly, you know, flow perfectly, but man, does that dish come together. Right now, it's my wife's favorite side dish when I'm cooking something up. Just do a little bit of rice in the rice cooker, which doesn't make a lot of heat in your house. We'll cook something up on the grill, and then I'll make these sesame cucumbers. They're really easy to make. You just make a dressing. Again, I've got that that yondu sauce I love so much on there. And then I like to use a Korean soy sauce. It just has a little bit different edge to it than maybe some of the other soy sauce you might find in the store. But any soy will work. A little bit of sesame oil, and then equal parts to the soy sauce of vinegar. I like apple cider vinegar. You could use rice wine or red wine, whatever you prefer, even lime juice or lemon juice. And then you just marinate them. I like to give them about 30 minutes, but they're pretty much good to go right after you marinate them. I like to get them when the cucumbers are small and tender and toss them in there. A little toasted sesame seed on top, maybe a little green onion. And there's this Korean chili flake I really like to use. It's also sold as Aleppo pepper sometimes. I like to sprinkle that over the top, and it gives it a nice bright color, and it's not too spicy, so it just gives it a little bit of zip.
And that yondu sauce you've mentioned a couple times, yondu, is it pretty easy to find in stores here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you can actually find it in a lot of grocery stores now. It's becoming more and more available every day. Alternatively, you can always order it online, but I like to use it because it's vegetarian, and especially if I'm making like that soba noodle dish, or if I'm making the cucumbers we just discussed. It keeps it vegetarian. It also is gluten-free. So that's another, you know, bonus, especially in today's climate where a lot of people are avoiding gluten or gluten intolerant.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Josh Swanson, executive chef at St. Norbert College. He's helping us stay cool in the summer. Great meals to make, dishes to make on hot summer days. You can find a couple recipes from Josh at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Michelle is with us now in Madison. Michelle, hi.
Hi there. Yes, I have two quick ideas. The first one is I have an Instant Pot. It's sort of a bigger Instant Pot. And I have a egg holder for it that holds 18 eggs. And in 4 minutes, with a little water in the bottom, I can make hard-boiled eggs with barely any heat in the house for my brunches at work. I take 3 to work, and that pretty much satisfies my breakfast and lunch. And for some reason, there's magic. No one's going to believe me, but I promise you that the shells fall off. You barely need to peel them. It's
wow.
Incredible. It's a miracle. We've been waiting for decades and decades for this to happen. So no heat and a whole week's worth of brunch at work. So, and then my second thing is I read in the New York Times that if you have a gas stove, and in my case, I have a Viking stove that I love that I bought 20 years ago, and I thought, this is going to be the stove I make my last meal on. I'm never getting rid of this. I will fix it and keep it forever and ever. And now, of course, everyone is talking about induction stoves and all that. And so in the New York Times, they had this idea where you just get for about $180, and I did get one, a one-burner induction, just one burner. And I keep it on a little board on my stove, and I've been cooking on it. Just a lot of pots work on it. People don't realize that their Le Creuset and those kinds of pots will work on an induction stove and create very little heat in the house. And it's a nice way to keep your gas stove if you really can't afford or don't want to get rid of it.
Michelle, wow, a lot of advice there. Josh, induction stovetops, as a chef yourself, what do you think?
They're great. You can use them without a hood vent industrially, which, you know, normally for a gas stove, you have to have a hood vent. They're definitely going to give off way less heat. So they're wonderful for that. You just got to make sure that you have a pot or pan with a ferrous metal core. A lot of people that I know that have gone the induction way have gotten a little frustrated about having to renovate their kitchen pot and pan situation to accommodate that burner. But they work great, and they are super precise.
Michelle, thanks a lot for the idea. Appreciate it. We'll go to Nancy now in Grafton. Hey, Nancy.
Well, hello. I got to tell you, up in our hometown up there in Edgar, Wisconsin, Marathon County, there was a lady had a tavern, and she would make these three-day pickles, and all it was cucumbers and onions and vinegar and salt and, you know, dill. And she'd make them in 3 days. They were ready. She'd put them on the bar, and the more pickles they ate, the more beer they drank. And my pickles are getting just about ready to make some three-day pickles, and I got everything I need. And so I just thought that's a really easy way to make some pickles, and they're so doggone good.
And Nancy, are we talking like fridge pickles here, or are you full-on processing in the big pot?
No, you just make them in a whatever size you got jar there. You know, put them in the jar and as many pickles you got, and you put your dill in and your onion and you make your brine, you know, and you put that all together, put it in the refrigerator, and 3 days later take them out and eat them. And boy, are they good.
Nancy, I'm right there with you. Josh, I'm a big fan of quick pickling stuff, whether it's cucumbers or red onions or you name it. It adds a whole lot of flavor to just about anything.
I'm glad she brought that up. You know, I like to call them quickles because they're quick pickles, right?
Love it.
But I'll tell you what, I'm bringing the beer if she's got the pickles.
All right. Nancy, thanks a lot for joining us. Josh, one more hot day here in Wisconsin. What do you got in mind for dinner tonight?
You know, you had Meathead on the other day, and
yes.
I'm honored to be in his company here.
Oh.
I would actually use a method that he does where you do the you know, two different zones on a grill and make some Bama white sauce chicken. So a little Bama white sauce chicken, make some potato salad, maybe a little salad, little greens on the side with some radishes. I think I got some breakfast radishes coming out of the garden that I'm going to pull out, and a couple of little cherry tomatoes, and oh boy, you got a meal.
Josh, that sounds fantastic, and thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I love being here.
It's Food Friday. We've been talking to Josh Swanson, executive chef at St. Norbert College. He joined us with advice on cooking on hot days. Hey, there's still time for you to keep sharing. We've got a lot of great ideas from you, and I love that. You can keep sharing yours over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What is your go-to on a hot day? What are you having for dinner tonight to not heat up the house too much? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Congress held a House Oversight and Accountability Subcommittee hearing on Wednesday on the topic of UFOs, officially referred to as Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena, or UAP. The hearing included claims by a former Air Force intelligence officer that the Pentagon had been concealing recovery and reverse engineering programs. Glenn Grothman is the U.S. House representative from Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. He chaired that hearing. I talked to him this morning.
Yeah, what led to this subcommittee meeting on these unidentified anomalous phenomena?
Well, we had a couple of congressmen who were very adamant that they wanted to have a hearing. There's a congressman who hasn't come forward yet, but he told me he had seen one of these things when he was a child. So given that there were a couple of very passionate congressmen who wanted this hearing, we decided to give it to them.
What were some of the main serious takeaways? Are there policy changes you'd like to see in the military when it comes to how they collect this information from their personnel and what they do with it?
Well, I'll tell you, I last visited this, I'm not kidding, in middle school. And I read a long book, and it was kind of like today. There were a small number of people who said they saw what at the time we called UFOs. And they felt the government wasn't taking it seriously. And a lot of people were seeing them but weren't coming forward for fear of ridicule. And at the time, the government said, well, we can't divulge this for national security reasons. We've got all these closed files. People can't look at them. It was the same thing on Wednesday. We had two naval pilots there who both said they and other pilots at the same time saw these UAPs. One said he saw what they call a tic-tac, like the little breath mint, mm-hmm. something that shape, but obviously much bigger, flying very rapidly, doing maneuvers that a normal airplane couldn't do. And there was another naval pilot over the Atlantic who said he saw a spherical-like thing, and inside the sphere was a big black box. Now, okay, they, first of all, they said that I could, and I eventually will, sometime in the next month and a half, receive a confidential briefing on whatever they can't tell me about publicly. But secondly, I think there should be legislation saying that they have to release these files eventually. I mean, this was, it went through a period in the like I said, the late 1960s, the early 70s, in which there was a lot of rumors that these things were out there. As far as I know, to this day, the files are not released on what pilots saw in the 60s and 70s. So I think if you go back 15 years or whatever, these things should be released. And then we'll know more whether there's something credible. I mean, I don't want to say that these aren't credible. We heard ourselves from two naval pilots who claimed they had a lot of other pilots who saw strange things that were executing maneuvers that a normal aircraft couldn't execute. So I think the big thing is a little more transparency from the military.
One key here is people hear these unexplained aerial phenomena and think, you know, aliens, something from another planet. The key here is, it seems to me, Representative Grothman, is pilots are seeing something out of the ordinary. Often we find out it had earthly origins. But if there's something up there, we don't know what it is. National security-wise, it's worth at least looking into. Is that fair to say?
Oh, no question. I mean, you have to wonder, is it something that other nations have developed that we are nowhere near developing? I mean, we ought to know that. And if it is something from outer space and there are other people monitoring us, well, we ought to know that, right? And like I said, it's not just two pilots. It's two pilots claiming a variety of pilots have seen it. They will say that commercial pilots are afraid to come forward for fear of ridicule or for fear that one of the big airlines won't let them fly for them anymore. So I'd be kind of curious as to see what they're going to tell me in a closed setting. And I think the public ought to know, because the public's interested. You know, we can kind of say what a strange thing to have a hearing on, but I'll tell you, I've received more phone calls on this and more press attention than I have for all the hearings I've held, what's going on at the border. I'm trying to show that there's some waste in military spending to hold down the deficit here. I get more calls on this. There's certainly a lot of public interest as well.
Do you think it's deserved public interest? I mean, you listed some other really important issues. Does this get disproportionate attention, even from us here at Public Radio giving you a call about it?
Well, right. We haven't called from you guys in a while, so that's illustrative of something by itself. I think, and I would like to maybe talk to some other pilots, but if there are a couple dozen people who have seen things high up in the sky going at rapid rates and stopping on a dime, and I mean, let's face it, if that's true, that's incredibly significant, isn't it? I mean, you can throw all the other headlines out in the paper for the last year. If we're being visited from another galaxy, I guess that's the news story of the year.
So what are the next steps on this? You've had this public hearing. You mentioned some private meetings, maybe some legislation. What does the timeline look like there?
Well, I think we'll have, to be honest, the legislature is leaving now. This is the one a year, 5 or 6 week out of Washington. But when I come back, I will meet with this guy, Gresh, and see what more he has to say. I do think we should pass legislation going back, say, maybe 20 years or 15 years that the military has to divulge or open up their files on this sort of thing so people can make up their mind, and maybe establish some permanent sort of agency as a depository for people who, like I said, see this type of thing. They are claiming that commercial pilots see this stuff as well.
I just wonder if, should there be room in this legislation if the Pentagon says, okay, maybe some of our people are seeing some of the stuff that some of our other people are doing that we're not ready to roll out to the public. Is there room for some classification where they don't reveal this information to the public?
That would be their argument. That would be their argument that even the pictures or the abilities of our own jets that are taking pictures, we don't want to reveal that. Those are the arguments that are out there, that there's stuff that we may have that we don't want to tell other countries about. But if it was something that we had 30 years ago or 20 years ago, I would think by now, unless they have a really good reason, I don't know why the whole public can't see this. And even though, because of the hearing, we are having articles on this today, this stuff has been around a long time, right? And maybe Congress hasn't had hearings on it, but the idea that certain pilots are saying that they see this strange stuff has been around, like I said, since I was in elementary school.
Representative Grothman, as you mentioned, you'll be in your district now for a handful of weeks. People might be contacting you about this issue. What issues are you hoping to hear from your constituents about over the next month and a half?
Well, we are working on the budget. And to be honest, people come forward and give me stories that I think are relevant, either to spending less or spending more in a variety of areas. So that's certainly one place I like to hear from people on.
Representative Grothman, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
That was Glenn Grothman, U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. I talked to him earlier today about a congressional hearing on UFOs and government transparency. UFOs aren't just in the news. They're in Wisconsin, apparently. This weekend, the village of Elmwood will hold their 44th annual Elmwood UFO Days to commemorate the many reported UFO sightings in their area. Amy Beckel is president of the Elmwood Community Club, which organizes Elmwood UFO Days. I talked to her earlier today.
Now, can you talk about Elmwood's connection with UFOs? What makes Elmwood the UFO capital?
Since the 70s, or in the at least during the 70s, there's been lots of sightings. Our local cop at the time, he had a sighting, is probably one of the more famous ones. A family that was traveling back from relatives had an encounter where a ship followed them down the road. Multiple other people have seen strange activities, ships, large glowing objects, good upstanding people in our community. So.
And what made Elmwood embrace that to become the UFO capital and host UFO Days?
They were looking for, I suppose, a way to bring activity to the businesses and stuff. And I assume that's when most of the towns were starting to do their celebrations. I see a lot of 40 and 50 year town festivals taking place. So I suppose they thought that maybe they should do that too, bring some business to town. And they had put out a request form. People could give ideas, suggestions for a name for the festival. And somebody suggested UFO Days. And it's been UFO Days since the very first festival in 1978. And we've kept it. There was talk probably 6-7 years ago. Some of the people, they thought that maybe we should change it, that they didn't like that wasn't a good representation of us. But the younger generation, they're like, no, that's what we're known for. People love the name, and it's unique. They recognize us, and there's not many that have an interesting theme to go along with their festival.
I was looking at the list of events for UFO Days and for the UFO Festival, and, you know, there's music and there's food, but what kind of unique UFO things do you have this weekend?
This year we were approached by several new speakers. We have our tried and true, Daniel Lancaster, he's coming back, and Bill Johnson usually does a presentation, but he's out with some health issues this year, but we'll be back next year because it's nothing concerning or whatever. But we were approached by Sarah Como, I think is how you say it. She is a cosmic ambassador. And she called us in January, and she wanted to get involved. And then since her call, we were approached by an author, Danielle Gay. She's coming and doing a book signing. MUFON from Minnesota has reached out, and they'll be here. They're also doing a presentation. Let's see. And Adrian Lee, he's coming. He has a paranormal show, Twin Cities Way. So he's relatively well known. And then this is the, let's see, fifth year that we've done our bus tours. We started that for the 40th anniversary and thought that that's where it would end. We would offer the bus tours to go to some of the local sightings, talk about what was seen and who saw them. And then we didn't give it much thought, you know. It was the 40th anniversary. We'll do it for that. And then just kind of put it by the wayside. Well, as the 41st anniversary drew closer, then we were being approached and said, well, hey, are you doing the bus tours again? And so at that point, then the committee that's like, well, we better think about this because people are now asking, what do you think? So now it's just become part of our festival.
We'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend.
All righty. Thank you.
That was Amy Beckel, president of the Elmwood Community Club. I talked to her about the 44th annual Elmwood UFO Days Festival starting today and running through the weekend. Up next, find out why video games are becoming a more common educational tool. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Imagine you're a young journalist who gets your first job at a newspaper in a small Midwestern town. Your first assignment, cover the local cherry festival. But then a catastrophic flood comes through town, throws the whole community into chaos. You got to trek through high waters and make the right connections around town to keep your public well informed. That's the premise of the new computer game Headlines and High Water, created by UW-Madison's Field Day Lab, which designs educational video games for students to learn various subjects. The lab's created 20 games and counting, plus other learning tools with virtual and augmented reality. Sarah Gagnon is the creative director for the Field Day Lab in the Wisconsin Center for Education Research at the UW-Madison School of Education. I talked to her earlier this year. Talk us through this new Headlines and High Water game. What do students do when they sit down and start playing?
Yeah, well, this game is a text-based adventure game, and so you take on the role of a young journalist. And this kind of like one of those choose your own adventure books that we play, like we read when we were kids. You kind of do that, but then it also has like extra things that kids are used to, like stats and like a story builder mechanic. So you play a series of six stories and you'll have to construct a story at the end of each one.
What are you hoping students take away from this? And what age range are you shooting for here?
I mean, I really think the story is pretty like broad. Like we've seen fourth and fifth graders play it and we've seen adults play it and have fun. But we made this for middle school because I was working with Sue Robinson, who is at the UW School of Journalism and Mass Communication as the partner for this. And we were talking a lot about how schools, like kids have access to news earlier and earlier, but there's not a lot of like journalism or media literacy classes that are devoted to that until high school. So we were excited about making this for middle school kids.
Can you talk about the value of using video games for education in the first place?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, you know, we can ask ourselves whether or not video games are good or bad. And there's like a lot of different opinions about that. And I think a lot of them are valid. We kind of approach it from a little bit of a different point of view, which is that's where kids are. Kids are playing video games and kids like video games. And so we want to be where kids are. That's kind of our theme. We want to go where they're going. Games also have really interesting affordances. Like you can fail and it can be fun, unlike taking a test and failing. In our game, you can fail in all kinds of ways. Like you can run out of time to write your story. Someone else can scoop you, or you can actually get lost in the flood and never make it to where you're trying to go. So all of those things are funny. You can start over. But the main thing is this is what kids are doing these days. And we want to be there making them beautiful, artful, really well-informed material.
I was a kid once upon a time and in some of the earlier days of computing. And I don't know, sometimes there are educational games that felt too educational. Like this is just school in a computer game form. How do you try to make it so kids are having fun and not necessarily raising their educational alert hackles?
Oh, I know. That's like the big thing you just said is that we actually have a saying in learning games design that some games are like chocolate covered broccoli, which means that, you know, you're like dipping it, yeah, putting some honey on it, whatever. So what we've done is at Field Day, as a creative director, I think of ourselves as artists who make games for learning. So first and foremost, we come at it with incredible art, incredible story. And then, you know, we have to like cover all of these topics. But first and foremost, I think of myself as an artist, which means we try to make things beautiful. We work with real writers. And by real, I don't mean that video game writers aren't real, but we work with artists who are kind of from outside of the video game industry and outside of the education fields, so that we're really thinking about people who are amazing storytellers or great game designers first and foremost. So I mean, I don't think learning has to be not fun, but sometimes, you know, sometimes it can be difficult. So it's a challenge.
Now, headlines in high water, that's journalism and media literacy. What are some of the other topics you've tackled in games at the lab?
Yeah, so we've done some history games. We had a game that came out last year called Legend of the Lost Emerald. We worked with the Wisconsin History Museum or Society, History Society, and that one is about shipwrecks around the Great Lakes. And so that one is set for fourth grade. We have a game called Lakeland that has to do with like phosphorus and the dairy industry. We just came out with another game this year about oceanic science called Wake, Tales from the Aqualab. And so our games are anywhere from like fourth grade all the way into university level.
And part of the goal, of course, is to get people actually using these. How do you make them available to schools or the public?
Yeah, that is the goal. We work with some of the leading researchers around the country and here at the UW to get these out. So one of the ways is making sure the art is beautiful. We partner with a lot of distribution partners, including like public media. So these games get between 5,000 and 15,000 plays a month. And that's because they're free, because we have distribution partners around the country. So you can go to our website, or you can go through like BrainPop or Wisconsin Public Media. And that's, yeah, so that's how we get it out there.
What kind of feedback do you get at the lab from teachers and maybe even students who have used these games as learning tools?
Yeah, we work with teachers to make the games, and they test them in their classrooms. And so we get great feedback, like, oh, this game is so addictive, I want to keep playing it. And we also get feedback like, why did you even make this thing? Or my advice is this game shouldn't exist. One of my favorite pieces of feedback was, why isn't this game Fortnite? And so, but we also get very, like, so, you know, there's like whole ranges, but we get all through the making of the game, incredible feedback from the teachers about how long it needs to be or what works and doesn't work in their classroom. And yeah, I mean, of course, the stuff I love hearing is how much they love it. That's my favorite stuff. But we always try to like use that feedback to, you know, impact the design to make sure that they really work for teachers.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That was Sarah Gagnon, creative director for the Field Day Lab in the Wisconsin Center for Education Research at the UW-Madison School of Education. I talked with her last spring about the educational video games her lab creates for students. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, there are lots and lots of ads out there for gold coins targeting seniors in particular. And in some cases, that's putting their retirement savings at risk. We'll check out the results of a new investigation into gold marketed toward older Americans. And the Inflation Reduction Act put a cap on out-of-pocket insulin costs for Medicare recipients. Did that lead to more people getting the medication they need? A Wisconsin expert digs into the change and what it means for people with diabetes. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.